Welcome to the Connected MB Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Templeman. On this episode, I will be joined by my co-host, Dr. Wayne Kelly. You will hear our conversation with Kylie from Merlin, the Manitoba Education Research Network. And later in the episode, we speak with Kirsten from the Manitoba Association of Education Technology Leaders. In this episode, we will focus on schools and the infrastructure that support them.
Hi, I'm Kylie Bender. I am the Chief Operating Officer for Merlin. I am also the treasurer for MRNet and on the executive of MRNet. So I hold positions in both organizations. Obviously, Merlin is my day job. So Merlin is what they call a special operating agency of the province of Manitoba. So we're essentially an arm's length agency. We are cost recoverable and we're non-mandated. So we charge for our services and schools and universities don't have to use us. And we only deal with educational organizations. So we don't do community stuff. We don't do private sector things. We deal with, there's 37 school divisions and 9 post-secondaries, depending on if you count some of the faith-based ones, and independent schools and First Nations schools. So we also do not deal with for-profit educational organizations. So they're businesses so the measuring stick usually is, do they get provincial funding for education purposes, right? So in that mandate, we basically strive to assist schools and universities with technology. So in our charter, it's fairly broad. In practicality, we do a lot of infrastructure stuff. So 36 out of the 37 school divisions use Merlin as their internet gateway. 8 of the 9 post-secondaries use Merlin as their internet gateway. All that traffic comes through us. We are Bell MTS's largest volume customer in the province, and we're also Rogers' largest volume customer in the province. So not largest by dollar amount, but largest by amount of bandwidth that we buy from those. They're our upstream providers. So basically what we are trying to do is to get economies of scale for technology, software and services that benefits the schools in the province. So one of the other things we do is we hold the master services agreement for Microsoft software for every single educational organization in the province. They all get their Microsoft software through us, so that we amalgamate that and we get the largest possible discount available worldwide for Microsoft software. There's no organization on their own in Manitoba that could get to that level of discount on their own. So there are savings there for all the organizations, including the U of M, which is by far the largest. So we do other things like security services, DDoS mitigation, monitoring of the network, web content filtering. We have an infrastructure as a service offering. We do consulting, all those sorts of things. So we manage and maintain the core of the network, and the schools and universities can buy connections to Merlin from basically any ISP in the province. So we have network-to-network connections with basically all the ISPs in the province. So if Valley Fiber in your area is the cheapest way to get to us, buy from Valley Fiber, they can send your traffic here. If it's Bell or if it's Rogers or if it's, ExploreNet, like those can all do that as well, right? So we can go on and name all of them, but there's a lot. So it really is about, can we do something as a group that lowers the cost or improves the value proposition for schools And we've done a couple of sort of research things on what that saves the schools in this province on the technology services that we offer. And the payback is nearly 4 to 1. So for every dollar they spend, if we didn't exist, they would spend about $4 to get that somewhere else for equivalent type services. I'm sure you guys are aware, like, people can always cheap out and do like and go buy something at Best Buy that's on sale that may or may not work properly. But for enterprise class stuff, it's because of the volume of everything we do, that's what exists. We run a very lean operation. We're 15 people from top to bottom. So we don't get any provincial funding to exist. We are all our salaries to keep the lights on, buy equipment, all of that comes out of fees that we charge to the school divisions. And generally, when we're looking at services, we're looking at what would this cost for them to do it themselves. And if we think we can pull together because of the volume or what have you, you know, can we do that for less than they could do it themselves? So as an example, years ago, and this service is on its decline, we were doing hosted exchange services. We had about 28,000 mailboxes at the high point in our hosted exchange before Google and Microsoft really started coming in and offering that for free to school divisions. But we charged $15 a mailbox a year. Private sector companies that were offering that service were charging $15 a mailbox a month. So just we're not out to make a profit. We're just out to cover our costs, right? So that's kind of the elevator pitch on Merlin. And I should say Merlin's been around since 1995 and came out of the Department of Education. So we're no longer in the Department of Education. We are in the Department of Consumer Protection and Government Services today. And so that's where we live. MRNet was also created in 1995, and it was basically created by Jerry Miller, who was the CIO of the University of Manitoba at the time. And where that comes is the federal government started funding an organization called Canary that was looking to improve research connectivity, research networking across the country. So federal government put money into Canary. Canary wanted to work with basically groups in every province. And so MRNet was formed in Manitoba to interface with Canary and get access to the federal funding. And so MRNet traditionally has been a high-speed network, private fiber network that interconnects with Canary's Cross Canada high-speed fiber network. Canary's recently begun upgrading all their national connections to 400 gigabits per second. We did, as MRNet in Manitoba, a bunch of upgrades this summer. So we're basically the core of the network is 100 gigabits per second. And then institutions can connect to, I should qualify this. MRNet was essentially post-secondary, and Merlin started out as essentially K-12. We have moved into post-secondary as we've grown and matured. MRNet continues to be just post-secondary. So the board of MRNet is all the CIOs from all the different post-secondaries today, and then myself as a representative of K-12. So it is high-speed networking for research and education purposes for post-secondary. It connects to other high-speed networks around the world. So if researchers were doing something with the Hadron Collider in Switzerland, like there's a high-speed connection to that that's not constrained by the internet. So that's traditionally where MRNet's been. MRNet and Canary are moving more into cybersecurity as they receive funding from the federal government to secure R&E. So there's a bunch of projects going on right now that how to help improve the security posture of post-secondary organizations across the country, and to secure that network and ensure that the intellectual property in post-secondaries is protected, right? So we have worked extremely closely with MRNet over the years. Again, my being on the board helps with that. Very close relationship with Jerry Miller, who was the CEO up until this past year of MRNet. And he decided to retire, and MRNet's hired a new CEO. So we continue to work very closely with the new CEO.
I think that's important, because so much of that is just kind of invisible and in the background. A lot of people don't know what makes the magic happen. But the limiting factor is you have to get to the core, right? Slowest link is going to be in places where communities still have limited choices or poor options for that connection that we'll get from the school building itself out of the community and then back to Winnipeg and then, you know, into these systems, right? Mm-hmm. So the systems themselves are more than capable and have lots of capacity and lots of speed, relatively speaking, but you still have to get there. Can you kind of paint a picture of where the schools are at in the province kind of now? And I guess maybe we've been kind of looking at kind of a 2019 to now timeframe, because there was so much done. Years. Well, it's because there was so much done during the pandemic, especially in the schools, or to compensate for the schools. So we've heard and we've listened to a lot of stories where there's been a lot of investment and a lot of improvement. So, you know, where were we in the 2019 kind of frame, and then where are we now? Because we know that there's disparity across the divisions, right?
Right. So we have always worked really closely with all the different ISPs out there, try and make sure that in areas that they have footprint, that they are able to offer schools the best possible connection. So for instance, last year, we did 100 gig network-to-network interface with Valley Fiber. So Valley Fiber can offer gig, 10 gig or more connectivity wherever they have footprint. Right. We also have a substantial network connections with Rogers, with Bell. Most of the interconnects we do with ISPs are at least 10 gigabits. We don't have anything slower than 10 gigabits. We also try and use some of the buying power of the provincial government to get better rates for schools and educational organizations. So interestingly, from our perspective, the pandemic didn't actually spur a lot of network changes. So if you think about it, all the kids went home. So on our network, where, you know, this past June, we were hitting about 40 gigabits per second aggregate for everybody that connects to us. During the pandemic, it might have been 4, because nobody was in the school buildings. So I will say that really, from my perspective, the problem was kids didn't have connectivity at home. So we did work with some school divisions to, you know, they would put up wireless access points in the parking lot or things like that, so kids could come to the school building, not into the building, but they could come to the school building to get some connectivity. Normally, that sort of stuff is against our AUP because we don't do residential or commercial traffic, but we made exception because of the pandemic. But we didn't see a lot of schools that, for instance, suddenly had to upgrade their networks because of the pandemic. In fact, it went the opposite way. People weren't doing things because there was no traffic from the schools. Even when the teachers started to come back and teaching from schools, it's a fraction of the normal population that you would see on the network. So for that couple of years, the amount of traffic we had on the network was, you know, less than 10% of what is normal. So it's kind of opposite to what a lot of people think out there, as far as, you know, technology became super important and people were doing lots of stuff with Teams and Zoom and all the rest of it, but they weren't in the building, right? They were doing it from home. And you might have had one teacher at the school, but the 30 kids were all from home. So they were generating that traffic from out there. Really what we find is as the ISPs improve their offerings in other areas, the schools take them up on it, right? Or they will buy the best available to what they can afford. So absolutely competition is important. And as the, you know, the RF Nows and the Valley Fibers, and let's be honest, Bell's still out there pulling fiber sometimes, you know, as they improve different areas, then new offerings become available and the schools take advantage of those. So, you know, most of the schools in this province, I would say, have at least a gig connection to the school building, which is generally sufficient for what people are doing today, right? So Winnipeg School Division, which has 80 schools and private fiber between all those schools, as an aggregate, they do less than 10 gigabits of traffic to us. So, you know, when you aggregate all those things and average them out, they're generally not exceeding, you know, what their capacities are, right? All the urban Winnipeg school divisions all have at least 10 gig interconnects with us. And Winnipeg One is the only one that's close to even getting there. Now in rural and northern Manitoba is completely different story all unto itself. In rural areas, you know, we're seeing in the last 5 years, like I said, people like RF Now and Valley Fiber that are making massive investments in rural Manitoba with fiber in a lot of places. That generally improves the connectivity to schools that take advantage of that. It also drives people like Bell to be more aggressive with pricing and different things like that. So we participated in, the government of Manitoba did an RFP for connectivity to all the government buildings in the province. So Merlin was one of the buying group members on behalf of education on that. So we drove some fairly aggressive pricing out of Bell compared to what they used to pay. You know, certainly there are still people out there that, you know, can do better, but you know, we try and do those things in the background to drive the price of things lower if we can, right? So,
and then for those schools that are in the north, you said like that's still a difficult spot. So there's some of those schools, some First Nation schools, they're running maybe Starlinks, or even old geo satellite kind of configurations. So which are extremely limited. Is there kind of a two-tier thing where there's that kind of a group that's really low and then the group that's kind of at the normal standard or a respectable standard, or is it just like a complete gradient? Is it like just all the way across the board?
So in my experience, and again, I can't present you with a data sheet to back this up in black and white, but in my experience in the last 5 years, a lot of schools in northern areas have gone to Starlink for exactly the reason you talked about. It is far superior to the old geosynchronous satellites, which are awful. So where people could, they did. So I can't say that the geosynchronous satellites are dead because I don't know all the communities up north, but if it's not, it's on its way, right? You know, we do a lot of work with, you know, in the bigger communities in north, the Thompsons, the Paw, Flin Flon, even Churchill. So MRNet has a 10 gig connection into Thompson and the Paw and 10 gigs all the way up to Churchill, because there's a bunch of research facilities in Churchill. So schools in those communities can get onto MRNet to get to Merlin. So those school divisions in those communities. There's nothing stopping other communities that are close from doing a wireless shot or some other investment into that. But generally the Starlink in the last 5 years has been the solution of choice. The issue with the Starlink, from my perspective, is it's a raw internet. So even if you have a school division or school board that wants to centrally manage things, it becomes more difficult to do any kind of central services off of a Starlink. So now you're talking about deploying some sort of SD-WAN or something like that. And so we've done a couple of pilots with SD-WAN things and Starlink, and it's touch and go with the latency that layers on top of that solution, right? So Starlink certainly has its place. It is, in my opinion, not a panacea that will fix all problems for everybody, right? So fiber is still the solution of choice if it's available.
Kylie, can you just give a little bit more context to the Starlink effectiveness? Just because it has come up in some communities. So is it an affordable option or comparable option for the schools, or is it a option of last resort?
So I would say that the places that are using Starlink today have really no other alternatives. So it's likely the best option that they have, especially when you're talking about northern Manitoba. In southern Manitoba, there are very few places where that is the best option available, right? So it is, in my opinion, relatively inexpensive. It's not going to be the cheapest in some places. And like I said, there are drawbacks to how that service works that sometimes make that not the most optimal. So if you're going to Tadouli Lake or something like that way up north, like there's no fiber there. There's no DSL. There's no cable modems. Like it's geosynchronous satellite or Starlink. Like that's it, right? And Starlink is going to be better than geosynchronous.
You're listening to Connected MB, a podcast exploring rural connectivity in Manitoba. Before we jump to our next conversation, a quick reminder, you can find links to today's research, reports, and community initiatives on our project website at connectedmb.ca. Now let's hear from our next guest.
My name is Kirsten Thompson. I have the opportunity of working with two of the primary tech organizations in Manitoba when it comes to the education sector. So one being MADEL, which is the Manitoba Association of Education Technology Leaders, and that represents technology leaders from each of the school divisions in the province, whether that is a coordinator, a coach, an assistant superintendent, an IT technician. It looks different from school division to school division. And I've also had an opportunity to be involved with MANACE. That's the Manitoba Association for Computing Educators. And that is a branch of the Manitoba Teachers Society as part of their professional development team.
Perfect. Joel, did you want to kick us off then?
Sure. So it's always a little bit interesting when we have kind of the key informant thing, because the purpose, and I think I'll give a little background just for the community side, is that we're trying to do, I guess, at least two major things here. We're trying to provide a platform for the communities to be able to tell their stories, good, bad, or ugly. The idea being, and that's one of the reasons we're doing the podcast in line with the research, and instead of just doing the research and, you know, to collecting it, going into a little hidey hole, doing some analysis, and then doing maybe a podcast at the end. we want to do it kind of as we're going to get that information out there and start that dialogue with different communities. The hope is that, you know, we know there's other communities out there who have similar issues, and maybe they're inspired by a story from another place. But then ultimately the second phase is to try to extract those lessons learned, right? So where are the commonalities that were successful? What are the pitfalls? What can we avoid? And ultimately we think kind of a phase two of this project is really taking what we learned from this and putting that into, you know, policy, advocacy, things like that. So are there barriers that are common to everyone, be it funding or something else? Where can we try to put focus to make, you know, systemic changes that we can help this whole process? So that's kind of the really, really big picture. So we start by asking the communities, what was the problem they were trying to solve, and how did they go about it? So maybe if we can kind of take that same kind of context and apply it to you, you have a very unique viewpoint. You get to sit at a lot of tables where there are representatives from all over the province, all in the educational kind of point of view. So I guess that's, and obviously the school is an integral part of these communities, and connectivity in the school and what the kids are learning and bringing home, like that's all kind of laced into all of this, right? So that's why we were interested in your perspective, right? Like if you were speaking kind of collectively for Manitoba, and we've been working on these kind of issues for a long time, you know, pre-pandemic even, about lack of connectivity and that impact. So I think what we're trying to do is kind of like a 2019-ish kind of time frame. So a little bit before the pandemic, through the pandemic, because it was such a significant change, and where we're at now. Where are we at, I guess, maybe? This is kind of a massive question, but kind of where are we at in the province education-wise? What is the problem right now if we had one that we were working on solving?
Well, coming from an education background, right, prior to being in this role, I was a classroom teacher. And so my heart always lies on the teaching side, whether I'm teaching youth or K-12 students, or now in this role, teaching adult learners through my various positions. And like that's always going to be my first focus, because that's what comes naturally to me, is working with students, working with teachers, working with community members on trying to let everyone be as informed as possible so that they can navigate the variety of devices that they have access to. Now, the variety of devices that they have access to and how they function is probably for me the largest sticking point and our largest pain point when we look kind of the large scope across the division and across the province, because equity continues to be a concern. One, in terms of infrastructure, and then in terms of devices. It's been very interesting because I do feel for a while with specific funding models, and divisions have the autonomy to have their own funding models, but there was a disconnect between the devices and what you really needed infrastructure-wise to make sure that these devices were running optimally. For a long time, operations and programming were two completely separate things. And so we would have maybe grants or pockets of funding or projects that were implemented, such as one-to-one or bringing in tablets or whatever the case may be at a certain point in time, which is absolutely fantastic. But then we hear sticking points of, we forgot to put the access points in the classrooms, right? I have an entire class set of tablets now, and there wasn't that opportunity to connect with the technician team to have that connectivity. So then you have students, say, sitting in a hallway, which I've done as a classroom teacher because that's where the access point was. Or on a broader scale, the disconnect between having a funding line for devices and you implement X amount of devices, whether they're laptops or desktops or tablets or even a BYOD program, but we haven't implemented increased infrastructure for the connectivity to support it. So you have 200 more devices, but you haven't upped your bandwidth whatsoever. And so again, it doesn't really matter that you have those extra devices, they're not running optimally. And so right now there, that disconnect continues to be a concern because we're always playing catch up. And of course that infrastructure is not easy, right? Depending on your school division, we're working with satellite options. We're working with underground options. We're working with partnerships with rural communities or cities. And those things don't always work quickly or on a school calendar.
And Kristen, just to follow up on that, can you give us a sense of, you know, when we've talked to communities and our experiences are like the technology continues to change and evolve. And unlike bringing in water or electricity or, you know, other forms of infrastructure, are the requirements both on the device side and on the connectivity side, you know, going to continue evolving in the future as you see it?
That's a really hard question to ask. And again, my background isn't necessarily on the IT side. I do know that, of course, our devices, even if we can move to, say, cloud-based servers, and a lot of our systems are operating in browser now, so the requirements on our actual device can be a lot less because we're not storing everything locally, which is nice. But then what we need connectivity-wise has grown exponentially. And so our bandwidth has to increase, and, you know, changes to how you move that infrastructure in, right? Are you able to access fiber? Are you still running on copper? For those that are running copper, we're still incredibly limited. So we need to get to a higher baseline than we are currently. If we put in fiber everywhere, is that going to solve the problem? I don't necessarily have the technical background in order to answer that effectively, but I would love at least that as a baseline now, and then to move forward from there.
Well, that must have impacts on curriculum. You know, if you have a provincial curriculum, and but you have, you know, school divisions that are kind of all over the spectrum when it comes to what they have for connectivity, what they have access to for a tax base, you know, how much they can spend on devices, that has got to be difficult to have some kind of standardization across the province if the backbone is different for everyone, if the tools at their disposal are different.
Absolutely. Right now, when you look at the 37 school divisions that are in Manitoba, there's a huge disconnect between some of the school divisions that have had to pay not only their regular monthly infrastructure costs, but they literally paid to bring in that infrastructure to the community, compared to a school that exists in a community where that infrastructure was already present. They just had to tap into the line. The cost difference in those are so stark, and I don't think people necessarily realize that, because those cost savings for the urban school divisions that already had that in place and had never really had to consider it, those can all funnel into the classroom in one area or another, whereas rural school divisions that literally have to pay for their own drilling and their own piping is drastically different.
Yeah, and you've got divisions who, you know, should be worrying about books and students and chairs and things like that, and they're worrying about underground fiber optic tunneling. It does take your focus and your funds and spreads them around pretty heavily. We've heard stories from different communities, some where the municipality and the schools worked together on projects, some where they kind of went on their own. I think we've explained this before, but across the province, there isn't, it doesn't line up. The school divisions and the municipalities don't line up. So some municipalities have multiple school divisions to deal with, and some school divisions have multiple municipalities to serve. So those relationships can be pretty complex. Have you seen in the places where the schools are investing and improving the home, like the students are going to leave the school, where even if they do have good connectivity at the school, they're going to go back home. Since the pandemic, has there been an improvement in the options for the students at the residential side?
I would say since the pandemic, there has been more options to choose from if you have the financial capability to take advantage of those. In our area, Starlink, of course, continues to be the most reliable in terms of meeting the most amount of people based off of their geographical space. It's not financially possible for all users still. The area that I'm in is one of the lowest areas in terms of poverty, not just in Manitoba, but actually in Canada. We're in the top 10 for childhood poverty rates. So when we're looking at families choosing to, you know, prioritize their at-home spending, yes, we have more options with connectivity. That's not always the first choice that they're making, though.
And that must just transfer that down to the classroom, right? Like if it's difficult to have a provincial curriculum consistently applied at the division level, if your classroom is diversely spread out as well, you've got some students who have that access and some who don't, some that have devices, some who don't, that must put that extra load on the teacher to develop essentially multiple assignments at multiple levels or give lots of options. That must add to the complexity.
Yes, the differentiation that our staff has to do and the staff across the province has to do is drastically impacted by what options are available at home. So we'll have ones that are using their learning management system, their LMS, and, you know, upload it to Seesaw, upload it to Teams, upload it to Google Classroom, whatever your workspace might be. Others are primarily focusing on non-tech options, either because they don't have the connectivity or the device at home, or even if it does exist, we know that upload speed is notoriously challenging to work around. And so a student can access something, but they probably can't share it back with their teacher. And so it's very different compared to an area where you know that all the students will have access and also the connectivity to support the active use of it, as opposed to just a passive intake of information.
Are there common barriers? If there were some top, maybe two or three things, I would guess that finances, money is going to be in that list. What do you see as the common contributing factors to this?
I would say there just continues to be an ongoing lack of support for the infrastructure. Like our conversations surrounding infrastructure have almost been about that in the ground infrastructure, right? We've been talking about connectivity, but even just basic cell phone connectivity, right? Four of the schools in our school division are in communities that don't even have cell phone service. And I know when I'm working with my team, even within the 20-minute commute from my home to my workstation, which I'm at right now, which goes down a major highway in Manitoba, I go down the number 5 highway, I lose service twice, even just on my device. So bringing in fiber or bringing in copper is still kind of down the line, right? We would want that basic access of simply just having cell phone service first. But I think there's been a fundamental misunderstanding that this has now, in my mind, become a basic infrastructure, right? Our world is surrounded by it. There's so many government forms, government programs where you need to sign up online. And there's an assumption that you're going to have access to these things. And that's still simply not the case for everybody.
Yeah. And I think that we've seen that in the urban assumption is moving more and more things centrally for the efficiency of it into the cloud, more and more cloud services, more and more data being centralized, which is difficult, if not impossible, I would assume, when you can't rely on an infrastructure, when you don't have the speeds or you don't have the availability. You know, if they're in addition to just the technical side, power issues in some communities coming on and off, not being able to maintain that local infrastructure. So I think that makes the users wary of utilizing all of the things that other areas take for granted, I think. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. And I think it has a direct impact on our families that have multiple children, our families who are perhaps trying to work from home themselves, are families who are naturally multi-generational households, so there's more people there. It creates more challenges than people are actually realizing.
So from a continuing with sort of the capacity element then, what, you know, as and, you know, we've like we mentioned, we've been talking with school divisions, we've been talking with communities, and there is often either partnerships between communities and school divisions, and you mentioned that, or sometimes there's complementary roles or capacities. And one of the things that we're really finding, as Joel was mentioning, like there's the financial challenge, but there's also capacity challenges for communities specifically to get connected. And you've talked a bit about the school division like challenges. How about the adoption or the use side? You know, so if we put the connectivity aside, how about the adoption and use side? And I know that's something you talked about earlier, but how do you see that opportunity or the need for communities? So I know this is sort of a vague question, but you know, you have individuals like yourself and teachers that have capacity in schools, and you have, there might be capacity in communities, but there's also need in both of those areas. Is there opportunities to share or to support or to train each other?
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the silver linings of what we had to experience as a society throughout the COVID-19 pandemic is that in terms of technological skills, our foundational baseline as a society had to raise. Everybody did. We had, you know, all of those wonderful stories of elderly grandparents and parents who, you know, were using things like FaceTime for the very first time, and we were doing all sorts of things and sharing in that space. So that baseline has risen, but there's still a lot of gaps there, right? And I think it's a really good opportunity to kind of take that baseline and run with it. I would hate for us to now have a generational slide. I don't want that. One of the things that I think provides the most amount of support is when you do a triangulation, when I'm talking from the school division side. So we have not only our adults, whatever those adults look like, whether they're teachers or administrators or custodians or librarians, we have our students, and then we have our community. So whether that's their caregivers, their coaches, the people that they're interacting with at the library, at the rec, whatever that looks like. And if we can all be on the same page in terms of, you know, some of those basic understandings when it comes to technology, I think that's where we're going to have the most amount of success. Everybody's getting the same messaging. Everybody has the same level of skills. A very basic example of this is when we're talking about cell phones, which I know is super common right now, but, you know, a common etiquette thing that sometimes gets overlooked still is, hey, we're probably not going to put that phone call on speaker when you're in a public space. And we see that all the time, right? But the adults who are perhaps doing it at the rec then translates to students who are answering in the classroom, right? And so if we can all be on a basic understanding and triangulating that support, it's just going to elevate the capacity of everybody.
Yeah, I don't think if we look at the longer timeline, how short of time we've really had, you know, like we're really, this is a pretty rapid change. I think we feel maybe sometimes that it's been around for a long time, but you don't have to go very far back before this is all very new to everyone. So the etiquettes, the way that we think about it is still evolving. And that's a great point that it kind of shows itself in day-to-day life. So that's really cool. I had a question, and I think this is school divisions, rural school divisions, small, need all the support they can get. What is out there beyond the school division level? And can you explain it from the rural school division point of view? So like the Merlins, the Department of Education, other school divisions, what is the larger kind of network look like as far as support goes? How on their own is a school division in the province right now? There's benefits to being autonomous, but you're also kind of on your own. So what does that look like from the smallest division to the biggest division kind of thing?
Yeah, of course. So at a basic level, every school division in Manitoba is, of course, connected with Manitoba Education, right? We receive funding from Manitoba Education. They are also the ones who will approve any of the curriculums that are going to be coming out, whether that curriculum is related to technology or just your simple literacy and numeracy that we're all familiar with in a school. And so Manitoba Education is there providing funding that then goes to our individual school boards. Now, your individual school board is the one who's going to determine what that funding looks like, right? They're provided with guidance and there's certain things that they can do. And now, when we're looking at school taxes, for example, school boards can use those in different ways, based off of what they deem to be necessary, based off of their community and the feedback that they receive. They then bring that down to, people like myself and other people in the tech world of what we're actually able to work with, right? So we all have access to Manitoba Education. How that plays out in each individual school division is based on the autonomy of the school board and then that senior administration team. We're very lucky that all school divisions also have access to Merlin. And so for many of us, Merlin is providing our connectivity, our content filtering, and they've done a fantastic job at also advocating for software purchases. These are things like our Microsoft Office 365 suite, or instructional software such as Gizmos, which is a science and a numeracy-based software. And so they're able to advocate at the provincial level, which then allows us to take advantage of bulk licensing, which we receive at a discount compared to if each school division were to try and go and advocate on their own behalf. And so that can definitely help and be a really great support when it comes to a small school division up to our largest school divisions accessing these types of things.
The connectivity and the digital aspect of it is only one component, and it's kind of the, you know, the a support mechanism that's often invisible and people don't see or don't know or are scared off by. So trying to bring some of this to light is one of the reasons that we're doing this, but it's not for the it's not connectivity for the goal of connectivity. It's connectivity for the goal of doing normal day-to-day stuff without having to worry about connectivity. That's when connectivity and technology becomes invisible, I think that's when you might get to the mark where you're utilizing it properly, right? But it does bring me to that kind of third phase. We'd like I said, I see it kind of as a cycle. The deployment of the infrastructure, adoption of people utilizing the technology safely and appropriately for themselves and improving their lives. But there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of things with blinky lights that are going and working, and there needs to be people who maintain that. And like you said, there needs to be people who can guide users on the decisions that they make. What software is appropriate for me? If I use this software, what are the implications? Have you seen in the last, you know, 5, 6 years a change in the IT support side? Are people kind of in communities now saying, oh, I could start a business and, you know, do hardware repair, or I could, you know, do more consulting? Is there an increased literacy on the IT side to support this? And if not, is that going to be a problem with sustainability of what we have?
I think it's very interesting because when it comes to our smaller centers, our rural centers, I think every community would be able to identify a business, whether that business, self-identified as an IT, quote unquote, computer store, which is what some of our community members would call them, right? There's always been something. Some of them have evolved really well throughout COVID and have added more options. Honestly, I think for a lot of communities and a lot of the things that you were to purchase, our members are still going through like a digital support system, right? They're usually trying to do some online troubleshooting. They're connecting with, Best Buy support or Walmart support in the small centers because you know, they bought it from there, they bought it in the online space, and the support is in the online space. When it comes to IT coming out and starting a business in small centers, I mean, we'd have to probably speak to Chamber of Commerce or something like that to see if they have stats on it. I would say it's probably way lower than we would want it to be. Well, I think it would be great to have more people in this space providing not only support, but training and just providing even contract options. I know sometimes my department is short and, you know, you don't have an option to connect with somebody else, right? Again, we're sending things off to the city. But then baseline connectivity in small towns, do I want to move from Winnipeg to Dauphin, Manitoba, if I know I can't get connectivity in my house, right? That's not really right. Where I want to start a business. Right. So the new things can be challenging, right?
Well, and I think that's why we're trying to highlight it as well, a little forward looking, is that, you know, it's good to add, it's good to improve, it's good to start utilizing, but, you know, they're just that third step just seems to be, how do we maintain what we have, and how do we expand? If we're going to start relying on this infrastructure, we're going to start relying on these tools, there needs to be humans. You can only do so much remotely. Someone needs to actually plug in that cable, or, you know, when something gnaws at the cable and makes a hole in it, you got to have a technician to repair it, right? So we've heard from different stories that's not necessarily available in every place, obviously. Is that something that's a concern? Is it being worked on? Is it something that would, you know, hopefully catch up as we go? I think it may not be a concern today. I think we're identifying it as a future concern, maybe.
We definitely need the sustainability piece, right? We saw through COVID the influx of community Wi-Fi spaces, which was absolutely fantastic, right? More Wi-Fi at libraries, right? Extending beyond their bank of computers, right? Wi-Fi in the outside space, as well as in their open infrastructure, increased Wi-Fi in things like rec spaces, in malls, in, you know, city buildings, for example. But if you don't have the long-term capacity to support that, again, you're going to have a community that begins to rely on it, especially if your residential options are not increasing. So you want to make sure that you're supporting it in the long-term and supporting it in a way that is responsible. If you're having people that are coming to this space, knowing that it's a workspace, for example, I can come to the city and I can sit down in their open office and I can, you know, work on my business proposal. Can you do banking there? Is their internet secure enough for that? Do you want, like, who's having access to your data? Again, a lot of this stuff isn't really discussed or transparent, or maybe they don't even know. So those gaps are still there.
I am very interested to hear your thoughts on artificial intelligence. It doesn't have to be limited just to the school environment, but that's obviously a huge issue. But if you want to start with the school, what does that mean? I mean, there's a whole discussion about AI and its impact on education globally, just generally. But I guess specifically, what does that mean in a rural context? Where artificial intelligence does rely on that heavy compute power and that connectivity and all the data sharing and all the ethics and all those kinds of things. So a massive question, but from a rural context, what does artificial intelligence have? Does it bring opportunity? Is it going to be something that makes the gap, the digital divide, grow? What does it look like now and as we evolve rapidly in that space?
So open bias, I am a regular AI user. And so I use it regularly, both in a personal capacity as well as a professional capacity, in terms of efficiencies, in terms of organizations, in terms of some content creation. It depends on what we're talking about. And so this is obviously going to be through the lens of somebody who is using it on a daily capacity, both personally and professionally. When it comes to artificial intelligence, I think there are tons of opportunities for users. However, I do think that for our community that has not had an opportunity to be educated on what AI entails, both in the use as well as the end product, the gap that we're seeing in terms of digital literacy is growing exponentially. And I want to speak on both sides of this, because right now, at when it first came out, right, and we were looking at just ChatGPT and then the paid upgrade to ChatGPT, there is the discussion surrounding equity, right? If I can pay for it, if I can pay for the strong computing, I'm going to have increased access. AI is essentially synonymous in almost every software that people are using to some capacity now. The level is going to still vary, but access to AI can be found basically anywhere. My basic concern for our users is, what are you putting into it? Are you understanding how that data is being used? Where is that data going? What are you doing with your intellectual copyright, your children's intellectual copyright? How is that going to be spit out on the other end somewhere, right? Helping businesses understand that this can be great, but if you're copying and pasting your sensitive information into it just so that you can create a summary for your board, where's all that sensitive information now going, right? How can we use it that way? And then on the flip side of it, the end product, just something as simple as images that are created, profiles that are created, deep fakes that are created, people not understanding that what you're seeing is not real, right? That this is the capability of AI at this point. Not only what you're seeing is fake, but the content that it's stating is also fake. And so that gap in digital literacy is growing so much faster than it was previously.
I had heard somebody mention what we see today in AI, what it can produce, the photo that it makes, it will never, this is as primitive and as dumb as it's ever going to be. It's just going to get.
This is the worst version.
Yeah, this is you're like, wow, that cat riding a unicorn. That's the amazing. That's so real. You're like, just wait, 2 days, wait five, that is going to pale in comparison to whatever that is going to be. Right. So yeah, absolutely. There's some huge impacts. So.
Mm-hmm. And, at the rural level, when we're talking about, say, small budget lines or small organizations, less access to people in niche positions, AI can be absolutely fantastic when it helps you with graphic design, for example, when it helps you as an assistant, when it helps you brainstorm. You might not have anyone else in your department. You might be the department. And so through effective prompt engineering, you can still, get some feedback without having to pay a third-party consultant, for example. And so those can be drastically beneficial for organizations if you know how to do it well and you know how to safeguard your data to the most extent as possible. But on the flip side, if you have people that haven't had an opportunity to be educated in the space and have a misunderstanding about media literacy, it's creating some gaps that are going to be really, really hard to then close. Because when we look at something like Meta, for example, not being able to share Canadian news, if you only have access to certain things that can be shared, which we know may not be accurate, and you don't have anything to compare it against, that makes that disconnect even larger.
Thank you for listening. Please join us on our next episode. If you're enjoying the series, we hope that you'll support us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast. Check out the show notes and project website for more information.